This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The state of Alabama appeals the decision that allowed a 12-year-old girl to get an abortion without her parents' consent. We talk about why on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. I'm Caleb Colquitt. Glad to be with you this morning on a Wednesday. Almost didn't make it in this morning. Cut it really close to the wire. Almost didn't make it in at all. And the reason for that is because I'm going on my way to work like I normally do. I take, because I live in Millbrook, I take the road, that exit, not the main one that goes into Cobbs Ford Road or Prattville, but the one slightly south of that. And they've got the whole thing tore up in road work. I was stalled sitting still for, about, 10, 15 minutes. And so I just barely came in on two wheels today. And I got to tell you, if you are heading into the Montgomery area, you really need to avoid that exit at all costs. I don't know what moron thought, hey, it'd be a really good idea.
Okay, yeah.
It would be a really good idea to do a bunch of road work in the middle of rush hour.
Well, that answers my question. You said that it's torn up, and I was thinking, is that something that they need to tend to? Or I guess they're tending to it. They're doing it during rush hour.
And it's not like a pothole or anything. They're repaving that portion of road. I don't know why they thought that it would be a good idea to schedule it during rush hour, but especially going into Montgomery like that.
Is that the state, city, county, or what?
I have no idea.
Because I think they do a lot of what, I know on 85, they do a lot of night work.
Well, here's the thing, and part of the reason that I'm not sure is, that street becomes Main Street. So
I know where that would be
under the city of Millbrook's jurisdiction, but the part that they're working on continues on to the exit ramp. So I'm guessing either it's the state or they're coordinating with the state or something, because that obviously would be the state's responsibility on I-65. So really not sure what it is, but if you are coming into or leaving Montgomery, avoid that exit at all costs.
Well, if they're listening, they are dumb as dirt.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I didn't have to be inconvenienced, and you're the one who, well, glad you're here.
Yeah, glad I made it in, too. So we are going to get to the news, though. That was just strange and wondrous tales of how Caleb got to work this morning. But definitely avoid that if you can. I did want to get to the news of the day and one of the top stories I wanted to cover. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on it just because there's not a lot of details out late just yet, but I thought it was important. The state of Alabama has officially issued an appeal. For those of you who don't remember the case, we've covered it ad nauseum here, going over some of the details just to let you know what's going on. 12-year-old girl, she is raped by a relative, and she is impregnated with his child, and because of abuse from her mother, she's removed from her mother, which means she is a ward of the state. And because she is a ward of the state, she requested an abortion, and she requested the ability to bypass the parental consent laws to do so. The court ruled and granted that. Now, we don't really know anything about the details of this case because she is a minor, and because of that, there are certain laws that go along with protecting her identity, protecting her from scrutiny, that kind of thing. So we don't really know a lot about the details. We don't even know if she's gotten the abortion or not, but that's the details of the case. This may have already gone through. The child may already be lost, but that was what happened in the case, and an appeal was not filed by the local DA. Like we said, not sure if he just ran out of time or he didn't think that he had a case or whatever the reason was. He was the person that originally tried to stop her from getting the abortion, lost the case, didn't take it any further. Well, the Attorney General of the state of Alabama has gotten in on this. Steve Marshall, just the other day, filed an appeal before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and he has pretty solid reasoning for why. So this is a statement by Attorney General Steve Marshall the other day about why he felt he needed to file this appeal. The federal court erroneously concluded that amendments to Alabama's parental consent abortion law passed in 2014 undermine a minor's right to anonymity and are therefore unconstitutional. The court ruling ignores the numerous protections afforded under Alabama law to a minor seeking approval for an abortion without parental consent. So now you're more familiar with the case. Here's what you have to do with looking at this appeal. Take out whether or not you agreed with whether she should get an abortion or not. Take that out completely. And y'all know as strongly as I feel about abortion, that's what I have to do when looking at this particular appeal. Take that out. The question before the court now is not, should she have been able to get an appeal? Nothing like that. The question is, did these laws, did the ruling of the court, because this is the way the court was able to justify allowing a 12-year-old to get an abortion without parental consent, were her rights to anonymity that are put in place to protect her and other minors, was that violated by her having to request consent from her parents? Because if that is the case, then that's what we're looking at right now. That's the question before us. So think she ought to got, if you think she should have gotten the abortion, if you think she shouldn't have been allowed to get the abortion, doesn't matter. What we're asking with this particular appeal is, was the court right in saying that the reason she should have been able to bypass the law and get an abortion was the reasoning behind that, which in this case was, did it violate her rights to anonymity? Was that taken into consideration? So that's what the case that Marshall is presenting right now. I've got to say, personally, just looking at it from my perspective, evidently it didn't violate it because we couldn't find out anything about her. We looked. I mean, I'm a news guy. I'm a researcher. That's what I do. And I looked through it. You couldn't find her name. You couldn't find where this took place. You couldn't find the name of the relative that raped her. Originally, I saw reporting that it was an uncle, but in the legal proceedings, it's not even listed as an uncle. I guess they either made that up or made some assumptions. Regardless, if you're looking at the case, you can't draw that conclusion because it just says relative. So it just uses initials instead of names. So there's nothing in here that would violate that, so far as I can tell, because we looked and we couldn't find anything. And you remember that we had Wynn Johnson on the other week, had him in on Friday. He's an attorney. He works for the Foundation for Moral Law. He's served with two different Supreme Court chief justices in the state of Alabama. He couldn't find out any details either. So apparently her right to anonymity was protected, just on the looking at it from my perspective. Marshall also said, during these bypass proceedings, the minor's right to confidentiality is preserved and the release of any identifying information is prohibited. Furthermore, parents or legal guardian participation is only allowed if they are otherwise aware of the proceeding. So far as we can tell, those protections are incredibly solid. There's no reason to, based on the details of this case, believe that they are not. Obviously, she did have to go through the legal proceeding and make this request, and that wasn't in any way violated so far as I can tell. So I really don't know where this is going to go. It's interesting to see where they're going to, because it's probably, if I had to guess, and because of the anonymity laws, we don't know this for sure. But if I had to guess, she's probably already gone through with the abortion by this time, based on the timeline that we're seeing. It's probably already taken place. So there's really no way for us to tell one way or the other if this will save the child's life or not, and we'll probably never know. But it is important to see if this goes through, if nothing else, for the sake of future cases like this. Now, granted, this is an insanely rare case, especially with the fact that it has both rape and incest, which accounts for a far less than a percentage of abortions in America, because rape and incest and worrying about the mother's life altogether still only accounts for 2%. So if you're looking at two of those, it's incredibly rare. So here's really what we're going to be looking at, looking forward. Whether you agree or disagree with this case, or whether or not she could have got the abortion, how you arrive at a ruling matters. How you get there matters. if you score a touchdown, that's all well and good, but if you got there by having 25 guys and the other guys only had 11, well, that matters. And so how the court got to this ruling matters, and it matters for future cases. Looks like they're going to hash this out. We'll keep an eye on it. 860-1440. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The general principles on which the fathers achieve independence were the general principles of Christianity. John Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. We are going to switch gears here for a second, but before we do, I want to mention to you, just give you a little friendly reminder that tonight we have the Biscuits starting their homestand against the Jackson Generals. This is a really important series for us because we are currently 2.5 games ahead of the Jackson Generals for the wild card. We're playing the team that is competing with us for that, so we've got to have a really good showing. So get out there, watch some high-stakes baseball. Tonight's Thirsty Thursday and Sock Hop Night. Also, we have the Max Fireworks coming tomorrow in the Friday game against them with Charities Night. August 12th, Saturday, in that game against Jackson, we've got another Max Fireworks, so back-to-back fireworks if you want to go both nights. And it's back-to-school night, and they'll be giving away AUM water bottles. And then, of course, on Sunday, as always, you have Kids Day, where you can run the bases and bark in the park. So lots of important things going on then. Also, the Dragons return to Montgomery for the 8th annual Montgomery Dragon Boat Festival. This event is free to the public and will have live entertainment, food vendors, exhibitors, and more. Stay after the Dragon Boat races for the Gun Island Chute stand-up paddleboard race.
Mm-hmm.
Montgomery's first competitive stand-up paddleboard competition will start at 4 p.m. and is part of the Southern Stoke Paddle Race Circuit. Join us and cheer on athletes from across the Southeast as they paddle on our 6 or 3 mile courses. If you're interested in competing in the stand-up paddleboard race, you can visit montgomerydragonboat.org. Proceeds to benefit Bridge Builders Alabama and Rebuilding Together Central Alabama. Now, I did want to get to this. This is news about, we were looking at some of the reports, and I'm watching this interview the other night by Michael Sentance. The Montgomery Public School takeover, we're sort of getting some updates on what they're planning on doing. They've done some evaluation now, and because of that, Sentance went around making the media rounds, essentially trying to make the case for what they're doing. And I'm watching this interview. He's talking about a lot of different things. One thing that I noticed, I didn't so much notice what he said, but what he didn't. And we're going to get into the meat of what he was talking about here in a second. But one of the things that I noticed is he's going through this and they're asking him, so what did you find? How are you going to present these solutions? He did not say one word about any kind of plausible plan to improve discipline in the classroom, removing the problem kids, or ousting bad teachers. And if you ask most people that have an involvement in the Montgomery Public Schools, that's some of the top things that they'll tell you need fixing in the Montgomery Public Schools. We've got to figure out a way to improve classroom discipline, because if you have an unruly class, it's very difficult to get any learning done, and of course that's going to affect test scores, and it's just the right thing to do. You have no way to remove the problem kids. They'll keep those guys in school and beg them to come back to class as long as they are there, because we're always horribly terrified, for whatever reason, of having a high dropout rate. Never understood why that was such a massive concern. I would 10 times rather churn out a handful of really good students that know what they're doing than sacrificing the education of the few for the many and try to get down those dropout rate numbers. Furthermore, has said absolutely nothing about ousting bad teachers. We have insane amounts of incompetency in the Montgomery County School. Now, there's some people in the Montgomery Public School System, some teachers that I personally know, that are great at their job, they love what they do, they try really hard, sometimes are in a bad situation, but they're doing the best that they can. So I'm not trying to say that all teachers in the Montgomery Public Schools, I'm not even trying to say most, but there is a plurality of incompetent teachers in the Montgomery Public Schools, especially when you're looking at the reports that have come out just in recent weeks. We had Dr. Lisa Keith, the vice president of the school board, come in and talk about this not long ago. We had some teachers that were not reporting finances, and on top of that, missing over 100 days out of the school year. That's gross incompetence. You can't do a job, miss 100 days out of the year, especially when for a teacher that year is actually less than 365 days.
Yeah, that's one teacher.
Right.
Missing that man. Yeah, she was here, and I just when she came up with those stats, I kind of did a double take.
You're like, how are they still employed?
They don't even teach 365 days to begin with.
No, that's the thing. They don't teach all the time anyway. They have a 10-month – most teachers are on a 10-month contract. And so you're looking at it from that standpoint. We've got to do something to get rid of the teachers that don't want to be there. Otherwise, they're getting paid exactly the same and not doing any work. And that's a losing strategy, whether you're running a company or running a government agency like the public school system. So it was abundantly clear to me that Sentence had absolutely no idea what he was doing. I mean, there's not a nicer way to put it. I'm sure he's a nice enough guy. I'm sure he's intelligent, but he has no idea how to fix the schools. Now, this goes back to one of my philosophies about government in general. And this was one of the reasons that I have had some contentious discussions with people over whether or not the state takeover was going to do any good. You cannot take a group of incompetent people and make them competent by putting a second group of incompetent people in charge of them. It cannot be done. You have to have at least some competent people in the mix.
Not even David Copperfield could pull that one off.
No, not at all. And so what we've got here is we have the State Board of Education, which can't even get their own ducks in a row, trying to fix a school system that can't pull it together. That is the situation that we are essentially presented with. Well, that's never going to work. You can't take incompetence and breed competence with another group of incompetence. It won't work. Now, the State Board, and I personally have some background with them. I used to be a state officer. We work closely with some state board employees. The state board has some really good people, just like the Montgomery Public Schools has some really good teachers. But it's primarily composed of political bureaucrats with education degrees that could not teach. That's the problem in education. You fail up. You can't teach? Well, you've got tenure, so we can't fire you. Let's make you principal. You can't win football games? Oh, that's okay. We'll make you vice principal. And then they can't do anything with that school, so they still can't get rid of them, so they move them to the county board. These people fail up because they sucked at being teachers, and now they're trying to tell teachers how to be teachers. Again, not all of them, but that's a lot of the Alabama school board. And that's the issue that we're running into. We'll be right back. Take it away, Rush.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, talk about the Montgomery Public Schools and the takeover, what we're doing with this. So we're talking about this interview done by Michael Sentence, who's in charge of the takeover. He's the superintendent. And frankly, again, I don't like to disparage people, but when they're doing a bad job, I have to call them out on it. That's part of my job. And this guy Sentence, blatantly, you can just see it. He has no idea what he's doing. And when it comes to fixing the schools, I think that he is sort of the epitome of why there's a problem in the State Board of Education. Because I was talking about right before the break, you can't have incompetence leading incompetence and somehow get to competency. The State Board, though it has some good employees, a lot of them are teachers that sucked in the classroom, and because of that, they got promoted because you can't fire them. You've got tenure, so what are you going to do with them? You take them out of the classroom, you move them somewhere else, or people that were really never had any intention of being teachers and got into education specifically to be bureaucrats, to be at the top. And I've known a few people like that. In fact, several teachers from my school, my old high school. I won't name her for obvious reasons, but she is at the State Board of Education now and was by far the worst teacher I had throughout high school. And to show you that she was the problem, she was one of my math teachers early on. I think it was ninth grade that I had her, and I came darn close to failing her class. I was in the advanced math course in my high school, senior year, had the high score out of my entire graduating class of about 70. So obviously it wasn't just me. But anyway, my point in all that is these bad teachers typically fail up and eventually wind up at the state board, and they're trying to tell other teachers how to teach, and it doesn't work, and that's the issue that we're running into.
Well,
this guy in particular, for example, has never been a certified teacher, ever, in his entire career. Never taught in the classroom. And on top of that, never been a principal, never been an administrator at a school, and never been a superintendent before he was our state superintendent. I don't understand it. How do you have a guy that has never been a teacher before trying to lead other teachers on how to teach? It will never work. And that's the issue that we're running into.
And he's paid more than the former superintendent.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I just can't get over. If you want to fix the Montgomery Public School System or any school system that is having issues, you find school districts that work, you find what works, and you take their advice. Taking advice from incompetent people is not going to work. If you want to find, and the thing is, it is not as though I get that Alabama's never done great when it comes to public education, but there are several really good school districts in the public system that we could look at. Enterprise, phenomenal public school system. Auburn, people literally move to Auburn just to have their kids in the Lee County school system and then drive to Montgomery. Their job is in Montgomery, but they move their entire family out to Auburn just so they can be in that school system. That's how good it is. So if we're just, about 40 minutes away from them by way of I-85, then why don't we ask their advice and figure out what they're doing instead of asking the state school board? That's not going to help anybody. So there are several good examples, and I could go on and on. There's several counties that have really good school systems. Those are just the top two that I thought of off the top of my head. But just like I'm always talking about federalism, when one state does something that makes sense, one of the ideas from the founders is that we have 13 at the time, because, of course, only 13 colonies then. We have 13 laboratories of freedom. 13 states that are all able to do different things, and when one state sees something that another state is doing really well, they can go ask them how they did it and try to implement it. And they don't have to implement the parts that they don't think would work for them. We can do the same thing with the state school boards in the different counties. Go to the boards that are doing really well, that have success, that have successful students, and figure out how they're doing it and implement some of those policies, implement some of their practices.
Well, how are the magnet schools doing it here?
Well, the magnet schools are better managed, granted. I would say that there's room for improvement there as well, but it does help when you weed out a lot of the problem students. See, that's the thing. Like I said, the biggest problem with the Montgomery Public School System is that they make such a federal case out of keeping students in class and keeping bad teachers. So what they do is they gravitate, or like the name implies, magnet, they take the better students, the top tier, and put them in the magnet school system, and the better teachers and put them in the magnet school system. So why don't we weed out the bad teachers in the regular public school system, and that'll start, it'll be at least a step in the right direction. So let's actually talk about, just for a moment, what Sentence did talk about. Because he offered a lot of solutions, none of which I think are going to have any meaningful or lasting effects in the Montgomery public school system. One of the first things he mentioned was lowering class sizes. Lowering class sizes is a noble endeavor. It is easier to teach a small amount of students. You get more individual attention than you do when you have more students. That stands to reason. 100% on board with that. Problem is, it's not going to cause a big change. Because a really talented teacher can hold an audience of over 100 easily. I had a professor in college, Dr. Milford. He was my rhetoric professor. So you'll hear me throw that term around a lot. He's part of the reason for that.
A rhetoric professor.
Well, you know, I was a communication major, so yeah. I had to take Introduction to Rhetoric, which was a great class.
I had never heard of that.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I went to school in the dark ages almost before. Was communication available.
No, but anyway, so I'm in Dr. Milford's class, and I got to be honest, I'd go to his class practically every day just because I enjoyed his class that much. I mean, you occasionally meet those really gifted teachers that really prepare for their lessons. You can tell they're interested in the subject matter. They bring the subject matter alive in the classroom. They use practical application. And because of that, there is a genuine desire from their students to learn more, to pay attention. A talented teacher can hold their students' attention. And you would think, well, this guy must have been really good at eliminating distractions. No, exactly the opposite. What he would do is, when you would ask about things like using a cell phone, using a laptop, that kind of thing in class, he'd say, yeah, if you can not pay attention in class and pass my class, that's your business. He says, but you're going to be missing out if you do. And that goes into something that I'm going to get into in just a second. So limiting class size is a noble goal. On board with it. If we can find practical ways to do it, I'm okay with it. But that's not going to fix the public schools, because the issue is not that we have classes that are too large. The issue is that we have students that do not want to learn and teachers that do not want to be there. That's what we're running into. And I realize that it's a little unfair to compare high school and college, because they are two different animals. But here's the thing, they don't have to be. If you've ever seen middle school or high school classes from different countries, primarily one that I'm going to use here as an example, Japan, it's like church in that classroom. They come in, all the students stand up when the teacher comes in, there's a sign of respect given, the teacher tells them to sit down, and they all have to pay attention, and here's why. Once you get to the middle school and the high school levels in Japan, they cut off about a third of your class. So if you're not in the top percentage of your class, you end your education right there and you go off and find a trade, which there's nothing wrong with that, nothing inherently wrong or to be ashamed of in doing any kind of manual labor. Some of the best, smartest people I know are business people that do what a lot of people would consider blue-collar jobs, and that's fine. But my point in all that is their education is seen as a privilege, not a right. And you get kicked out if you're unruly in any way. And because of that, there is a sign of respect that is shown. And so we could have exactly the same thing in our high schools. Now, I get that that's not the hand that we were dealt. I get that that's not a society that we're living in, and it's impossible to start over this late in the game. It'd be a change that would have to take place over a long amount of time. But if you're going to take a long journey, you got to start somewhere. So that's something that I think that we ought to be shooting for, something we ought to be moving towards. Like I said, take ideas that work in other places and implement them here. So that's really where I think is a good starting point. It's something that we can look forward to. And when we're looking at the respect of the classroom, we can look to other places, other countries. That ought to be something that the progressives will just eat up, taking ideas from other countries. I'm all right with that. I'm all right with taking things that work from other places and trying to implement them here. That's okay. So let's start with actually looking at solutions that matter. He talked about a lot of other things. We're going to get to that in just a second. 860-1440. We'll be right back. Six gun in my hand.
Behind a gun. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I scruple not to call him an enemy to his country. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Looks like we've got somebody on the phone. Apparently 3 hours on the radio just isn't enough for him. So
an honored guest.
Yeah, let's let's go to the Elk Man on line one. Good morning.
Now, listen, I just got one question to ask you, because we come from two different worlds, and our perspective is a little bit different.
Right.
I want you to define to me what a failing teacher is.
one that is not adequately conveying the information to their students. For whatever reason that may be.
Okay, but what if the student is just not interested in the information being relayed?
Well, then that's not their fault.
Again, that's why I want you to define to me, then there's got to be, that's too broad. There's got to, because there are two parties involved in the education process. There's the teacher, and then there's the student.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better to define it as, if a majority of the people that you teach cannot either comprehend or retain the information? It's too broad of a term, because there are some teachers who are better at teaching in what we call parabolic way, in parable. Different kids learn different ways. Do I blame the teacher if I have the inability to either grasp the knowledge or unwilling to grasp it?
Well, see, what you're actually talking about here, and I agree with you, by the way, it goes back to the fundamental understanding of human communication. So what the essence of my degree was in, you've got a message sender and a message receiver, and there can be a problem with the message sender, there can be a problem with the message receiver, or there can be a problem with both. So what we've got to do is isolate where the problem is and then figure out a way to fix that. I think a lot of times in the Montgomery Public Schools, not always, but a lot of times, it is a problem with both. And so what we've got to do is we've got to get rid of the students that are unwilling to learn and simultaneously get rid of the teachers that are not good at teaching. Now, maybe if what I'm picking up from what you're saying is accurate, and you can tell me if I'm mischaracterizing it, if we have an issue with both, maybe what we can do is get rid of the students that don't want to be there first and then find out, well, if the students want to learn and the teacher's not helping that along, then we need to look at the teachers. So I don't know what order necessarily we need to do it in, but there's a problem with both.
I believe that it is the formula that is that issue here, and not the folks preparing the form. I believe that the formula is flawed, because all over America, my friend, not just in Montgomery, Alabama, it is the same complaints all over America and urban America. So I believe that the formula that we're using is wrong. And you called a lot of people incompetent. I think the word incompetent is a little bit harsh. Most of these folks have advanced degrees like you.
Right.
I don't believe they're incompetent. It's that we are dealing with a bad formula. And if you have a bad formula, no matter who works out the problem will not be changed because we're using a bad formula.
Well, there are definitely some issues that we're running into, Kevin. I agree with you 100%. Goodness knows that I've talked quite a bit about the problems with the education system in the country at large. But at the same time, there are school districts that are churning out good kids that are under the same system. And so there are issues with that, I agree. But obviously there are school systems that are able to overcome that regardless.
And most of them, though, what you will find is they have either modified the formula or evaded some aspects of the formula in order to get where they are.
That's certainly true. And I appreciate your call. Appreciate your take on that. So what Kevin's saying is not uncharacteristic of one of the issues that we continuously run into, because the federal system does provide a lot of red tape and bureaucracy. And frankly, this goes to a point that I was going to bring up anyway, is that the better teachers are the ones that don't deal with this. Because one of the things that Sentance brought up, he said that there are structural issues and programs that we didn't have in place, to which my immediate reaction was, oh, good, more paperwork and red tape for the teachers to deal with that distracts them from their work in the classroom. Yeah, that'll work really good. And I say this as somebody who's lived with a teacher, really lived with two teachers, because my father was a teacher for 27 years. My sister taught for a while. She got out of it specifically because of that bureaucracy, and she couldn't do her job. And I also had a mom that was a substitute teacher for a while. So, I mean, I was ingrained in the education system very early on, saw it from the inside, spent my summers at school helping out with different kinds of schoolwork, with the principals, with the counselors, that kind of thing. So I've been ingrained in that system for a very long time. And I'm telling you, looking at it, one of the issues that you're running into is bad teachers, bad bureaucracy, and occasionally students that are problematic. And this was one thing that I wanted to talk about as well. You can't say that there aren't a problem with the teachers when you've got a plurality of teachers missing half the school year. You can't say that that's not an issue. One thing that he was talking about, sentence was improving attendance. Now, granted, this is a real problem with both teachers and students. Apparently, they can't get either one of them to come to class in the Montgomery system. And we talked about that report where there are teachers missing over 100 days out of the school year. But here's the thing. Quit begging people to show up. If you don't want people to show up, say, get out of here. If you don't want to be here, leave. I never have understood why we almost beg students, please come to class. No, if they don't want to be there, kick their butt out. They're distracting the other kids. Don't force them to be in class. Same thing with the teachers. First thing I would have done coming in is all those teachers that have missed over 100 days, unless it was like you got cancer or had maternity leave, something crazy like that, you're automatically fired. We're not even considering keeping you on. You don't want to be here? Fine, leave. You see, unless you clean house, unless you fundamentally break down a broken system, all you're going to do is build on a bad foundation. And no house built on a bad foundation can stand. Hour 2 coming up. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Tensions mount between America and North Korea. We go there now on Tactics.
Don't you know, things will change, things will go your way.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. You are listening to this Thursday edition of Tactics. Hour 2 is on. Glad to be with you. I'm Caleb Colquitt, in case you've accidentally stumbled onto our frequency by accident. Accidentally stumbled on it by accident. Wow, getting a little descriptive there.
Accidentally. Yeah, I thought that sounded strange.
Yeah,
but it's Thursday.
It was right after it came out of my mouth. I was like, something wasn't right with that, and then I realized what it was. But anyway, speaking of things not going right, we've got some issues going on between America and North Korea. Now, the biggest news story, and I'm watching the media coverage of this, and I cannot believe my eyes. Well, actually, I should take that back. I can believe it. I'm just, at this point, it almost is to be expected, in fact. I'm just tired of it. So, Trump made a comment the other day that if North Korea continues down the path that they're on, that they're going to see fire, fury, power, the likes of which the world has never seen. And, you know, that's the case. That's Trump. That's who the guy is. But I'm watching the media cover this, and we're going to get into this in just a second, and that is all they are talking about over and over again, just going in with a scalpel and trying to dissect every little bitty part of that statement. And I'm sitting here thinking, do we not have better things to do? Now, I'm not saying that we don't need to concentrate on what's going on in North Korea. Far from it. I'm saying I can't believe that we're on the verge of war and the media can't shut up about what Trump's saying. That's really going to be the focal point that they are targeted on. Now, as Americans who have been watching Trump for, about 2 years now, I would say even his enemies, if they're being honest with themselves, can look at what Donald Trump was saying there and know that he's not actually talking about threatening North Korea with nukes. Why? Because with Trump, everything is the biggest, the best, you've never seen it before. That's who the guy is. He's a marketing guy. In fact, if you're watching that same speech, look about, 3 minutes before he said those exact words, and he's talking about the opioid crisis, and he's saying the opioid crisis is a epidemic like the world has never seen. Because that's who Trump is. Now, is the opioid crisis serious? Yes. Is it going to be a problem that we have to address? Absolutely. Is it the Black Plague? No. We have seen much worse than the opioid crisis. But that's not who Donald Trump is. Everything has to be giant, huge, huge. When he talks about his hotel being brought up, I mean, this is who the guy is. Everything's the biggest, the best. Nobody's ever seen anything like before. It's great. It's fantastic. All that stuff. He overstates things. That being said, I do have a bit of an issue with him overstating things because, yeah, we as Americans get that he's just using hyperbole, but other countries don't necessarily do it. And so, yes, I do think that Trump should be more cautious with his language. That's been something I've been critical of Trump on since day one. The guy has to be more careful about the way that he says things because, as a reality TV host, you don't have to be real worried about that. When you're the president of the United States, that carries a whole different weight to your words. And so, yes, I agree with even most of the liberal media that probably wasn't the best phrasing of it. But come on, people. Are we really going to obsess about this? Now, sort of to contrast that, Secretary of Defense General Mattis, Mad Dog, he was talking about this same issue the other day. And he said that if the threats from North Korea continue, that they are going to lead to the end of their regime and the destruction of North Korea's people. Okay, when Trump says stuff like that, he's probably overstating things. When Mattis says it, I absolutely believe it. When he says that this is going to end if they don't knock it off with the end of their regime and the destruction of its people, I don't think he's kidding. I don't think that's hyperbole. I think Mattis means exactly what he says. I don't think there's any amount of exaggeration whatsoever in that statement. And it sounds to me, based on what Mattis is saying, is that warfare is absolutely being considered as a possible option now. And that's probably what should be on the table. I don't think that we should take any options off the table at this point. Because we're in the... Right now, we're in such a state of uncertainty, I think we have to consider everything. So when Mattis is telling us that this is, he's essentially all but saying that warfare, open war with North Korea is a option, which technically we never ended our war with them. We never actually got to a treaty. We're just kind of at a ceasefire at this point. Keep in mind that Mattis is exactly the same guy who said that war with North Korea would be catastrophic. That if we went to war with North Korea, the death toll would be massive. And that this would be the kind of fighting like we haven't seen since the 1950s. Okay, so Mattis, who is someone that I believe it is fair to say normally when he's talking about things, applying the standard of literally to him is not unfair. Now, would I like a president that you could apply the standard of taking them literally to? Yes, I would, but that's not who Donald Trump is. But if we're looking at Mattis, he has a record of when he speaks, he's speaking literally. So if this is the same guy that's saying open warfare is essentially on the table based on the way that he's talking about it, and he's also the guy who said that war would be catastrophic and would be something that we haven't seen since the 1950s, well, then what does that mean if he's saying both of those things? If you're asking me, I think he's saying that this may no longer be the worst option. Mattis isn't the kind of guy that just jumps into war without counting the cost first, which is good considering he's the National Defense Secretary. So if that is the case, and if he's now considering warfare as an option, which I believe that he is based on his rhetoric, then that means that there are worse options available now. He is saying that, at least if you're following the logic trail, it is a possibility that North Korea could strike America, attack an American territory, attack the American homeland, that there is some kind of factor that has played into the intelligence that he has now that says to General Mattis, a guy that takes his job very seriously, that is saying to him, as bad as open war would be, at this point, it may not be the worst option. That ought to be terrifying to people. I know that it is to me. So, we've got to get our ducks in a row and buckle down, prepare for the worst. We'll be right back to talk about this 860-1440.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Now, we're talking about the situation in North Korea, of course, that escalating. The recent response to the Trump administration and the sanctions that they've put out in favor of them, which, by the way, the world is now behind us now that they've seen that North Korea has some nuclear capabilities, which that's a really good thing. The world has essentially said, okay, America, we're on board with this. They supported the sanctions, very harsh sanctions. It's going to really hurt the North Koreans. The next thing that they've said is that they're going to be attacking Guam. Well, why Guam? Because if we were going to attack and bomb North Korea, which Kim Jong-un probably believes is going to happen now that some of the things that have come out with President Trump, because, again, I understand it, you understand it. When Trump said what he did, he's just using hyperbole. That's the kind of guy that he is. And to us, it's harmless. He's just, you know, saber-rattling. Kim Jong-un probably takes it seriously, and so his response, he's responding seriously to hyperbole. And so what he's saying is, I have an actual plan. I'm going to attack Guam, because he knows that if we were to attack North Korea, if we were to bomb them, that attack would come from Guam. The Air Force that we have stationed there at Guam, they would be the ones to go there and carry out the attack. And what drives me nuts is that the media is just so worried about what Trump is saying, they can't contain themselves. And they're not actually talking about stuff like this. Strategically, what would benefit North Korea, the strategy that they may use, the things that we as Americans need to prepare for if we're stuck in this open conflict. And so based upon that, it really bothers me that the media is just so worried about what Donald Trump is saying that they're not considering or talking about what actually is going to make an impact in our relationship with North Korea. Now, granted, I wish that Trump had taken a slightly more subdued approach. Frankly, I'm glad to see that we have a president that is willing to do what it takes, that isn't going to just cuddle up to dictators and make nice and say, I'm glad to have someone that, goodness knows that Donald Trump is no Reagan, but that, like Ronald Reagan, is willing to say, those guys are evil and we got to deal with them. That honestly is reassuring to me. I wish that he had said it a little more eloquently, but that I'm on board with. But the way the media is so worried that Trump and goading Trump on, it drives me nuts that we're literally on the verge of war, and the vast majority of the media are busy fighting over whether Trump's statement was a good idea or a bad idea. Because if you're watching Fox News, you would think that this is the greatest statement that's ever been made by a president, and they're busy combating the other media, trying to say that what Trump said was appropriate. They're not talking about the issue either, because they're so busy trying to support Trump and defend him that they're also not talking about the real issues. And so it just drives me crazy that we're sitting here watching a spectacle when there are real problems going on in the world with our relationship with North Korea and with other countries and our allies. Let's go to the phones. John from Millbrook is online, too. Good morning.
Good morning. One of the things I think that the president needs to recognize is his need to understand his opponent and the mindset of, when I say his opponent, North Korea.
Right.
He needs to understand the Asian mindset, and, you know, if he is put into a situation where he doesn't feel like he can back off without maintaining his own honor, then the way that I understand that people in the past have certainly reacted over there is they'd rather die than give up what their, you know, their position is. They won't do that. So, I mean, I think he needs to understand that. And what you were talking about the rhetoric is certainly true. It's a good thing to actually be very, very careful about what you say. And I'm glad, too, like you, I'm glad, too, that he's showing that we do have strength and power. We're not going to let anyone kick us around, which has been done to a great degree in the past and hasn't gotten us anywhere. I'm glad that he's more out there, but he just needs to be more careful about it. Now, I'm not a huge Trump proponent myself, but I do think that we're still in a better position. And the media people act like they're not even a part of this country. It doesn't matter about that. It's more about the story that they get to tell and the stir-up that they get to do, as opposed to, hey, I live here too, we may get blown up. I mean, they don't look at it that way, which is something that I've always wondered about them. They're Americans as well that are in danger.
I think they genuinely don't take the situation seriously. I think that they really have put it up in their own mind that, oh, he's just a dictator, he's just saying this, he won't really do it. No, Kim Jong-un is nuts. He will launch.
Yeah.
I mean, he will attack if he thinks it's in his best interest, and your point is great, because you have to keep in mind, his people literally worship him as though he is a god.
If he will kill his own family to be in his position, he would react.
Yeah.
There's no question. I mean, if you'll kill your own family members because there's a problem there, he will certainly react in such a way that he won't care. He wouldn't care less if he started World War III.
Well, that's the thing. If this man is so calloused in his own mind that he's fine with not only murdering his brother, but doing it in a brutal way with chemical weapons and doing it in public so that the world can see, do you really think that he's going to be concerned with the cost of American lives based on a war that he started?
No, not at all. And one thing about the progressive media that I listen to occasionally, they have defended him. And they think he's better than Trump.
I know. There are certainly, because I've been watching that too, there are certainly people in the media that have tried to push that point. I wouldn't say that all of them have, but certainly we've seen more than one do that. Before I let you go, I understand that my producer was telling me that you had a comment on the previous topic.
Yeah, about the mission of a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have the obligation to convey the information that's there, but you also have the part of your responsibility is to motivate and to try to determine, as Kevin mentioned earlier, each kid learns differently, and I always thought my job was to figure out what that was, to get that kid to fulfill his potential, because they do learn differently. And I would want to see that out of any teacher, but what the government's going to try to do is make everybody cookie cutter so they can measure it in some sort of way, and that really won't change the system down there. And I talked about that on his show. So I think I hear the same thing from this state superintendent of education who is doing the takeover. He's saying some nice things, but they're not going to fundamentally change the problems that you have in Montgomery if that's what they actually do.
Yeah, I didn't have the time to get to this in the first hour, and so I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about this real quick. But one thing that I noticed about every single thing that he brought up, what was fascinating to me is he gave no timeline about when this should be accomplished by. He gave no goals, so no way to measure exactly how effective it is. This is something, and it's a hat trick that bureaucrats pull all the time. They'll give you some flowery language and some things that sound good that they're going to try to do, but there's no way to actually gauge whether it worked or not. And that's one of that's one thing that I noticed about it.
You know what I think? Right now, I would love to have Trump as the secretary over our education system to come in and kick people. Maybe it would be better if he were in charge of education here and let someone else be president. Maybe he'd be better suited for it. I don't know, but because he wouldn't use flowery language. You know what I mean? I mean, my point is they need someone to come in there with guns blazes, and everyone from top to bottom, kids included, all the parents and everyone need to recognize that this is going to be a huge, as Trump would say, a huge shakeup to fix the thing, and that's what it's going to take. If they just put in some little programs and do a little dog and pony show visitation thing like I've seen so many times, it's not going to change anything.
No, and all the things that they're talking about his main point was that there are these structural issues that they have programs that aren't being implemented that we need to implement. If you ask me, that was one of the few things that maybe Montgomery Public School was doing right, which is ignoring a lot of the paperwork. They try to implement all these little things, and they love throwing around the word accountability. The only way you can really gauge a teacher, and I think you'll agree with me on this, is to watch them teach. That's it.
Absolutely.
It's the only way you can actually gauge how good a teacher is. And having them fill out forms and looking at their lesson plans, that doesn't tell you whether a teacher is good or not.
Has nothing to do with it. Take care.
All right. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. But yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about the North Korea thing, and this is the thought that I wanted to leave you with before we come back. Yes, Trump absolutely needs to be more cautious with his language. I think that anybody that's looking at this in any kind of objective way would say that even there are more eloquent ways to reflect the sentiment that Trump was trying to get across without making it sound like you're going to rain down, Tomahawk missiles on North Korea. There is a more elegant way to say that. Trump's not really the guy to do that, but not just for our sake, but for the world's. I do think that Trump needs to be a little more cautious in his rhetoric, but nonetheless, it happened. We can't take it back now. Let's move on. 860-1440, we'll be right back. Lies, tell me sweet little lies.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com, 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Now, I'm watching the media cover Donald Trump and his rhetoric the other day, and one thing that drove me absolutely crazy is they were saying, well, now that he said that, he's essentially drawn a red line in the sand, and we have to act on that because it's a red line, and we're going to lose credibility with the rest of the world. They were goading the president on, essentially, to do a preemptive strike on North Korea.
To make it worse.
Yes.
Throwing fire on, oil or gas on the proverbial fire.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to back down from anybody, but I don't want to put our lives at risk.
No.
And our way of life.
And what drives me nuts is these are exactly the same people that were cheering Obama on when he refused to do anything to Syria after he actually used the term red line and then said if they use chemical weapons on their people, that's the red line in the sand. We will do a strike on you, essentially, if you do this. And then they did it, and he just essentially drew another red line in the sand further back, which, whether or not you agree with the president's when I say the president, I'm talking about Obama at this point, back then. Whether or not you agreed with the president drawing that red line in the sand or standing up or going back on his word, which, by the way, with Syria, we absolutely should have done a strike. That's an easy win. They're not a nuclear threat. That's an easy fix compared to North Korea. But regardless of how you felt on that, when it comes to the media, it just blew my mind. The same ones that were giving Obama a pass when he actually used the term red line in the sand. And then they cover Trump and they say, well, now the president has no choice. He essentially has to, for the sake of his own credibility, strike North Korea. And I'm sitting here thinking, are we really willing? And keep in mind what I said about Mattis, that if we engage, and he ought to be the guy that knows, if we engage in open war with North Korea, it would be devastating. The casualties would be immense.
For North Korea.
For North Korea. Well, for South Korea.
And so, yeah, he basically said, you know, the whole country will just be wiped off the face of the earth. And I don't even think he's talking about necessarily nuclear, just the conventional.
No, here's the thing. If you're looking at just conventional weapons,
mm-hmm.
North Korea, for about 60 years now, has been preparing to be able to wipe out Seoul within a matter of hours. That's what they've been preparing for six decades. And they can do it with conventional weapons. Before we even knew they had nukes, our assessment of what their capabilities would be is that they would wipe out Seoul, level it to the ground within a matter of hours. In less than a day, they could take out one of the most densely populated cities in the world just with conventional weapons, even if they don't have any nuclear capabilities whatsoever. Think about what else they've got. Our intelligence has also said that they have biological weapons, smallpox, yellow fever, that kind of thing. That could cause no telling how many deaths. They're close enough to where they don't need intercontinental ballistic missiles to attack countries like Japan,
they could attack Guam, like we said, just with the conventional weapons we already know for a fact that they have. And so if we engage in war in North Korea, the casualties are going to be insane. And our best case scenario is that we go to war with North Korea. We are only at war with North Korea. Russia, Iran, China, they don't jump in on this. And we have these mass casualties. Sadly, that's the best case scenario that we have. And so we're at the point now that there are no good options left. And this is the question that I would ask to North Korea. Is it really worth the cost in lives, millions of lives on both sides? Is it worth that cost for the sake of credibility? I don't think it is.
But you're also, you know, in the perfect world, addressing some country and some leader with a modicum of common sense.
True. But my point in all of this is that is not a reason to go to war. Now, if, like I believe that Mattis is looking at, because of the way that he's speaking now, if he's looking at warfare as a real legitimate option because he thinks that that might cause less human death than the other options, that's a viable reason to go to war. If he thinks that we have to do something because we're going to wind up with an awful lot of people dead if we don't, that is a legitimate reason to go to war. Going to war over the sake of credibility, that's not a good reason, especially not when we're talking about literally millions of human lives on both sides. And there are a lot of Americans stationed in South Korea. So this is not going to end well with us. There, we have essentially exhausted all good options. The time to act on North Korea was a while back before they had these nuclear capabilities. Now, unfortunately, it looks like they have the technology to deliver. We don't know how good their guidance system is. The intelligence community is not 100% on consensus with what they're able to do. But one thing that is constant is that they all are saying at this point that there is at least a chance that this could take place. And because we don't know exactly, we know for a fact they're moving more in that direction, even if we don't know exactly how far along that path that they are. So at this point, we have definitely exhausted all of our good options. We got another caller. Let's go to David on line one. Good morning. David, you there? David? I think we lost David.
Well, hello, maybe.
I guess we did. All right, well, that's fine. We'll continue on. So here's what we're having to do. Because we coddled Kim Jong-un, we let him get away with far too much for far too long, and we exhausted our good options. The time to be worried about them getting nukes was, about a decade ago. So now what we're having to do, because y'all know if you've spent any time listening to me, I tend to be an idealist. That's who I am. I look at the ideal situation, that's what I shoot for. You can't do that in this situation because ideally North Korea wouldn't have any nukes. We can't change that at this point. Whether they have them or not, we have to consider them a nuclear threat. When you're playing a game of poker, you don't play a hand full of junk as though it's a royal flush every single hand. Now, you can bluff your way out of some situations, but eventually they're going to catch on to you. And so you have to deal with the hand that you have right now. And right now, we're going to have to pick the best bad idea because that's all we've got left. I don't know exactly what the best bad idea is at this point. I think we're going to have more information. And I really do have faith in maybe not so much our commander in chief, but definitely the staff that he's assembled around him. He's put together really good people that know what they're doing. I really hope that they have good information and we can get some good intel because they're going to need good information to make good decisions. But we've got to play with the hand that we've got. There's still time to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power. There's really not time to stop North Korea. We have run out of clock. We're down to the last play, and we've got to make a decision. You know, this is kind of a silly analogy, but I'm going to use it. If you've been listening to me for any amount of time, you know that I'm a big comic book nerd. One show that I really like is Young Justice, and there was this would be my lesson to the media. The show Young Justice, one of the leaders of the team is Aquaman's sidekick, Aqualad, which, by the way, you're thinking, well, that's silly, yes, but believe me, his sidekick is much cooler than he is. So he's the leader of the team of young superheroes, and they're in the middle of a mission. There have been some trust issues. He lied to them to try to protect them from something, and in the middle of the mission, they're disobeying his orders and making wisecracks at him, not listening to him. And finally, he says, look, if you guys don't want me to be in the leader anymore, if you don't want me to be in that authority position, then I'm going to step down the second this mission is over. But we're in the middle of a mission right now. You got to find some way to come together and listen to me until this is done. I really do think that's the stance we have to take with Trump. Media, you don't like Trump. We get it. We've known that for a really long time now. But when it comes to this, we are in a crisis situation, and we could very soon find ourselves in a much bigger crisis. And so at least on a matter that could literally mean millions of American lives, we've got to find some level of unity when it comes to this. I'm not a big fan of Trump either. Y'all know that. But if we don't find a way to come together on this, we're going to find ourselves in an awful lot of trouble. Like him or not, Trump is the commander-in-chief of the United States of America, and we've got to find some way to support him in that, even if we have some differences. And if we don't, this situation is going to go south very quickly. 860-1440 or the numbers. Chaplain's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. I did want to mention this before we get into the chaplain's report real quick. The whole situation with North Korea, our country really does need prayers right now, so I would ask everybody within the sound of my voice, and I thought this was an appropriate way to start out the chaplain's report. Please, please pray for our country. We're going to need it within the next coming months, because whatever happens, it's not going to be a good solution. Maybe this winds up being like the Cuban Missile Crisis and just passes quietly in the night. Obviously, that would be what we would hope for, but you know, it's not looking good right now. Certainly pray for the country, because Tigglypuff is not going to take this lying down. He's always horribly concerned about appearing weak, especially on the world stage or in front of his people. So he's going to do something to try to show that he's in control. Hopefully something doesn't involve killing people, but he's not above that, as we've seen from his past antics.
May I interject that?
Sure.
Wouldn't be a bad idea, just pray for everyone involved.
Oh, yeah,
pray for the North Koreans, too. Pray for South Korea. Cooler heads will prevail.
I hope so.
Because that scares me.
I mean, I think that it ought to, and that's something that you can look at the biblical narrative. War has been a part of human nature for a very long time, but luckily, God has always been able to pull us out. But with this whole, if we have a couple nuclear powers going at one another, that's really never happened. And so, I mean, you could argue the Cold War, but those are proxy wars. North Korea actually has nukes, and we would be at war directly with them. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but it could. So definitely, definitely pray for our country and pray for everybody on all sides, because we're at the point where we need them. All right, let's move on to the chaplain's report. 2 Corinthians 12:7-10. This is a passage where Paul is discussing with the Corinthian church some of his own sins. And this is one of the things that I love about the scripture and the biblical narrative. And actually, one of the things that I've always said is proof that it is an accurate historic document. You see, especially in ancient literature, usually the heroes, in particular, if they're supposed to be religious figures or something else like that, they do the best that they can to portray their leaders as perfect, flawless, no real. Look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, all those things you can look at. The characters are usually presented as perfect people that don't make mistakes. That's not the case with the biblical narrative. In fact, the Bible kind of goes out of its way to show the human flaws in most of its main characters. you could maybe name a couple of characters that aren't mentioned very often in the scripture that you really can't find fault with, but in the Bible, everybody from Moses to Elijah, it talks about their mistakes, their frailties, and Paul was no different. Paul's actually very open about his weaknesses and the things that he struggled with, including his own sin. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 12:7 through 10. Because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I implored the Lord three times that it might leave me, and he has said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weakness, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weakness, with insults, with distress, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong." Paul had real problems, just like the rest of us. Paul had issues that he had to deal with. But I think what separates Paul from us sometimes is that he understood that these frailties were not something to hide from one another. I mean, this is about as public a confession as you can make. We're still talking about his sin 2,000 years later. This is something that he struggled with and was open about, and he said that if nothing else, he looked for the silver lining. It kept keep him humble. When you're Paul and you're getting all these revelations to write inspired word of God, I think that maybe you could be a little prideful, a little arrogant, think that you're on top of the world. And Paul cites that specifically, the greatness of the revelation. He said, to keep me from exalting myself, I got knocked down a peg or two. One thing that I would say is sad, though, is that I have heard many a Christian reference this scripture as a way to justify sin, saying that, well, Paul struggled, so this sin that I'm working on, that's just a thorn in my flesh. I can't really control it. That's just the way that it is. That's my thorn in my flesh. And they say that almost as though, well, this is the one sin that I really struggle with, so that's the one that God's just going to overlook. There's a huge difference in being excused and being forgiven. Is the grace of Christ powerful enough to overlook that sin that you're having a particular problem with? Yes, it is. The scripture makes that very clear that we just read. However, look at Paul's remorse, the way that he was fighting it, the way that he implored God to help him overcome it. This wasn't something that Paul just accepted as something that was a part of his life and he couldn't do anything about. He fought it and continued to fight it, probably long after this letter was finished. And what he did was he used that as an opportunity to teach people, look, I'm not perfect either, and use that to help them with their sin, with the things that they were struggling with. Yeah, we all have weaknesses, but with Christ, those can be overcome. And that was the thrust of what Paul was saying here, is that those weaknesses can be overcome through the power of Christ. And that's what we should take boast in, not use it as an excuse to sin. We all struggle with something, but just because we struggle with it doesn't mean it can be ignored. That's what a struggle is. We're fighting against it. Stay the course, friends.